Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer, John Roerink, and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, Trey Grayson, he's the former Secretary of State in Kentucky, and he's also been with the Harvard Institute of Politics. And no, he's not talking necessarily about the Kentucky Derby, but he is talking about election reform and a particular initiative that he's interested in here in the state of Michigan, and we'll get to that a little later. But first, one of the big questions now in the legislature right now that has created the next wave of the Cold War between Arlen Meekhoff, the Senate Majority Leader, and House Speaker Tom Leonard is whether the legislature should do something with marijuana legalization. Now that it's on their plate, is it a better strategy to pass it now and then be in a position where you can change the enacted law with a majority vote, or roll the dice, see if the people approve it, and if they do, the legislature then would need a three-quarters vote in order to approve the initiative. Jack, you've been over in the Senate the last few weeks as this has been a topic of conversation. What's the sense you're getting?
The sense I'm getting is the light is on red, don't go right now unless something changes. I think a big part of that was the Democrats coming out and saying, don't count on us to supply votes. So basically, you're talking about the Republicans coming up with, you know, the total number of votes they need to pass the legislation. So in the Senate, where they've all worked together for years, going back to being the House and so on, maybe they could talk enough people into getting it passed in the Senate. But my gosh, how on earth do you do that, supplying all 56 votes in the House?
John, why wouldn't the Democrats support legalized marijuana if it was put in front of them as far as the legislature is concerned? It seems like this would be a slam dunk yes vote.
I would be very skeptical. Look, it's probably going to make the ballot anyways. Probably going to come in front of the legislature without them sort of preempting it. If you support it, why do you want to give the what could be a Republican majority beginning of next year an opportunity to change it or severely curtail it? Why not let the people put in place what's already been circulated, what's already been sent around, and let them vote it in? I think the bigger issue, though, as Jack said, is on the Republican side. I mean, how can you ask the House Republicans, or Senate Republicans for that matter, to vote yes on marijuana? You can make the nuanced argument that it's so we'll have more control over it. But at the end of the day, any primary opponent can come in and say, he voted for legalized marijuana. You know, the business community, our biggest source of support as Republicans, has come out square for against this. And look what this Yahoo did. I mean, why would you put your members in that situation?
Jacob, when I thought that when they wrote this marijuana legalization proposal, they tried to model it after the state's medical marijuana law anyway. So what would there have to be to tinker with?
Yeah, well, I think there's a good governance argument to be made on both for Republicans and Democrats. That's kind of on the other wing of the political issue of this. Obviously, if you make it easier to amend later, that will be helpful if any problems arise. And while, yes, the recreational marijuana proposal mirrors kind of the medical side, we've already seen the legislature pass some cleanup bills, I believe, this session for the medical marijuana regulatory framework that was passed in 2016. So right there already, you see that even though it mimics the medical system already in place, we've already had to amend that. And so if you make that easier to amend later, I think that's a kind of a good governance argument that both Democrats and Republicans might need to consider.
I also wanted to get your opinion on the process of putting in place a legalized medical marijuana system here as far as the regulatory system goes. It has gone extremely slowly. At what point are we really going to see a state-licensed medical marijuana shop operational here in this state? When are we going to see this?
Well, that exact question was asked at a reporter roundtable with the Bureau of Medical Marijuana regulation last week, and the director, Andrew Brisbrough, committed to within a month we will see a licensed shop open and ready for business, and that is predicated on a lot of things that the state licensing board actually approves, not just a step one, but step two application for these businesses. And so the applications going before the licensing board have been slow. There are a number of reasons for that the state has tried to explain. And so we'll see in the next month. There's about two meetings left and there's supposed to be a lot of applications coming before us. So they have said that they're going to get a fully licensed person before in the next two meetings or so. So we'll see if that actually comes to fruition.
Man, I'd like to be that one person who's legally allowed to sell marijuana in this state for that first few months. That would seem like that would be a great business to be in. We'll see how that happens. All right, so marijuana is already through the meat grinder. It's in the legislature's hands right now. And as we were adding things up earlier this morning, we got seven ballot proposals that could end up going in front of the people. Realistically, Jacob, seven ballot proposals. Marijuana, the voters not politicians redistricting, an anti-prevailing wage repeal, which would mean pro-prevailing wage. We've got an increase to the minimum wage. We've got the paid sick leave ballot proposal, a boost in the energy standards, and this voting rights initiative that we're seeing from the ACLU and the League of Women Voters. Jack, when you've got seven ballot proposals on there that would seem to be something that the progressive community would rally behind, is that good in the sense that it draws out progressive voters? Or is it bad in that you've got seven bowling pins lined up that you could just roll the ball down and knock them all down?
Well, it invites what we saw in 212. So it ends up being a back to the future thing on 212, where the Republican side can put up ads and so on against all of them at the same time. I don't think these ones are changes to the Constitution, so you got to get probably a little bit more creative even than they did in 212. But I'm guessing instead of everybody trying to come up with this many million, that many million for each one, we've seen this before. They'll probably come up with one campaign and find some way to get people to all vote no. And the thing that's good about that is all you have to do is find this wrong with this thing, this wrong with this other thing, and possibly sell it.
But if you're a progressive interest group right now, John, if you can't get this thing passed, get whatever it is that you're shopping passed in 2018, you might as well just hang it up for a few years, wouldn't you think? I mean, that's kind of the philosophy that these folks are going with.
Oh, yeah, I think that's probably the argument they're going with. And certainly, you look at the mix, and it's a mix of ballot proposals that should really excite their base. But that doesn't mean you can't make an argument to the rest of the voters that to raise enough questions to start pushing some... No messages, though it drives down support for these things.
And we've talked about this too before, Jacob, where we've looked at potential ballot proposals getting on. Will they get on, get off? What's different about these is that they all seem to either have money or organization behind them, where you would think it's very realistic that all of these will get on the ballot.
Yeah, all of these have shown kind of in their campaign finance reports the resources needed, and also in many cases that they're paying for signatures, which are, you know, kind of your combination that you need. The other thing you want to point out is look at the, when you're talking about whether there's going to be a coordinated no campaign against these, I mean, look at the interests that would want to see these go down. I mean, the utilities are going to come out against the energy proposal. You're going to see the chamber and the restaurant association come out against minimum wage. I mean, there's plenty at stake for people who want to see these not be successful. And so I think there'll be plenty of money going the other way on these.
One last thing I want to bring up before we bring on the guest is the latest attempt by Abdul El-Sayed to knock Sri off the ballot, questioning his petition signatures, when Sri turned in pretty close to twice of what you need to get on the ballot. And yet his camp is going line by line to try and knock him off. Now, he's not alone in trying to do this. There are several other political candidates who are trying to knock off their potential opponents because of bad signatures or perceived bad signatures. We're seeing that in Detroit with the Conyers, Ian Conyers, going after his great second cousin or whatever relationship would be, John Conyers III. But you're seeing this kind of across the state. And so I'm just kind of curious to watch how the Secretary of State handles this, because it could be a situation where we could be seeing this more and more, where this is used as a tool to try and knock people off because the signature collection is less than perfect, but just collecting signatures in general is a less than perfect exercise in democracy. So how strict do you want to make this? You know, just because I signed my name sloppy, maybe I botched my zip code, maybe it's, you know, instead of 49815, I put in a 8. It looks like an 8 instead of a 5. I mean, there is some danger in getting too nitpicky on these things, isn't there, Jack?
Yes and no. I mean, you have the PR impact of that it was questioned, which it puts that doubt on the other person. So you get that aspect. And, of course, with El Sayed and Sri Tanadar, you've got the revenge factor. Well, Sri came after me, you know, on the stuff about, you know, whether I should be allowed to be on the ballot or not. And, you know, I'm going to turn around and challenge his signatures. So that's a factor, too. But again, the idea that, boy, it was questioned that you even got to write a number of signatures, et cetera, a signature, if there was monkey business with that, well, you're hitting your opponent with some negative, potentially negative attacks.
Besides that, we're operating now in the post-McCotter world. So you're not running a decent campaign if you don't look at the filing petition signatures of your opponent, because you don't know what you might find. And you may suddenly be a big winner by simply taking an hour or two out of your day, going down and looking to see what's what with those signatures.
Yeah, and I think it's going to depend on the case-by-case for some of these issues with petitions, because I think in general election law is kind of, you know, unless there's some kind of really egregious issue, like I think the idea is if people do the requisite things, you know, voters should have a chance to vote for their candidates. Take, for instance, Matt Morgan, who I don't think anyone is challenging him, but he had an issue with the address he listed on his petition. And the legal defense that they're going to mount by Mark Brewer is that because he listed a P.O. box instead of his home address, is that is throwing him off the ballot, you know, the right penalty for someone who otherwise collected enough signatures. Going with Sri Tanadar's like signatures and whether they're valid or not, one would argue maybe it's a little more egregious that if there are not enough valid signatures, I mean, I think that's kind of cut and dry, is if there's enough, you know, electoral support to put you on the ballot. So I think the courts and the Secretary of State have to weigh kind of what is more of the egregious offense when it comes to these paperwork issues.
And I think we've seen one end of the goalpost already set with Karen Spranger, where they determined, okay, there is no way on earth she lived in this place. So yeah, she should not be serving in office. And it's kind of that we see how far the courts are willing to go on that, but how far in from that are they willing to go? Because Sylvia Santana didn't pay her campaign finance fines in time, does that mean she should be kicked off? Or, you know, what should be a proper penalty if not, right? So these are things that the court's going to have to figure out.
Yeah. What are the paperwork violations or otherwise that are egregious enough to not give voters a chance to vote on a otherwise eligible candidate for office? I mean, I think these are the issues that the court and we'll ultimately need to decide on.
Well, I want to go back to Sylvia Santana, because I find that interesting that she didn't pay her fines and then she went ahead and filed her paperwork to run for office. And then when she found out she had fines she had to owe, then she went ahead and paid them before the filing deadline, as opposed to, let's say, George Cushenberry, who I don't know if he's ever really filed much in the form of campaign finance documents really on time or in general. It was $30,000 to the Secretary of State. He's going around running for second Senate district. You know, one is trying to do the right thing and the other just doesn't seem to really care. So should the same penalties apply to both of them? Something to think about as the Secretary of State and the courts make the final determination as to who's on the ballot. Joining us on the other end of the line is Trey Grayson. He's the former Secretary of State in Kentucky and was also the director of Harvard's Institute of Politics. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Glad to be with you.
Well, tell our listeners what your current project is and how that ties into Michigan.
So one of the things that I'm really passionate about right now is in the area of the elections, I'm trying to improve election voter registration, specifically online voter registration. And I actually had the opportunity about a month ago, I guess, to come testify before the Michigan Elections Committee in my support for Michigan becoming about the 30th state to adopt online voter registration.
And why is that important to be able to register online? I mean, folks register right now basically by going to the Secretary of State's office, and you can do it at the post office too, can't you?
Yeah, a lot of different places. You know, with the motor voter law that was passed, gosh, back in the mid-90s, I guess, a lot of government agencies now are required to offer voter registration cards. But online is it's a modern tool. You know, it's convenient. A lot of people are used to doing things online, especially in a more mobile society where people are moving around all the time. They find that they have to change their addresses a lot. But there's some real practical reasons why a state might want to offer this. I mean, for one thing, it's cheaper. So if you fill out a piece of paper, you know, you think about the way you normally do it. You fill out your name, you print it with a pen, you hand the card in to somebody. Then somebody in the elections office has to actually type that information and key it into a database. But with online voter registration, you're connecting it to, you know, the individual types it on a form online, or you're tying it to the driver's license database or some other database, and that data is already there. And I can give you a perfect personal example of, you know, when I was Secretary of State, I found out that my birth date was wrong, not because I wrote it down wrong on the card, because I actually went back and looked at the card, but the person keyed it in incorrectly. So you get some errors in our databases, and those can cause problems on election day. So it's just cheaper. You know, you don't have to pay people to type it in. The person already does it. It also is more accurate for that same reason. Connecting the databases can be more secure, and it's just convenient. I mean, my daughter is 17 right now, but she'll turn 18 later in the year, and she's going to be 18 by election day, by the November election. So in Kentucky, she's allowed to vote in the primary at 17, and she went ahead and registered to vote from her phone in our living room because she had a driver's license. So the state of Kentucky, and this is how it would work in Michigan, just found her data entry and transferred it over securely to the state voter registration database, and she was registered. It was pretty easy, and so she's real excited about voting in a couple weeks now.
Obviously, folks are a little leery about doing that kind of stuff online. They feel like it's going to get hacked. We keep hearing about how the Russians allegedly hacked our last elections. How do you alleviate those fears that this is a real secure way to register to vote?
There's a couple ways. One, paper is actually pretty insecure. A lot of times the way people get registered is they do it through voter registration drives, where somebody who they often don't even know comes to them with a voter registration form, asks you to fill it out, and then you hand it back to them. And sometimes that means you're handing over a social security number, or it's the full number or the last four digits. So via paper and giving it to strangers or giving it to volunteers and having those papers go around is not a very secure way. And so that's something that could be easily manipulated. And so the irony is that maybe online is actually safer because, again, my daughter's example, where she really didn't have to do much at all because the data is already in that driver's license and the state registration just pulled it. Now, how do you safeguard it? You know, there's the way they build these things is that there are not direct connections. So when you log in online, you're not literally putting it into the database. It usually goes into some sort of queuing file, and that allows an employee to then process and put it in. So that kind of safeguard can certainly help. But then you've got backups and databases and things like that. And again, having the driver's license tied together, that's usually the most secure thing. It's actually something great that Michigan does, is having the two so closely connected under the Secretary of State's office. But there are a lot of safeguards that you can do. But if somebody doesn't feel comfortable typing it online, they can obviously still do the old-fashioned method. This law doesn't get rid of paper. It just provides that option for online. And we find that in the states that have adopted it, they feel very comfortable with the changes that they've done, and people have generally felt comfortable making their updates or registering for the first time online.
You mentioned that we would be the 30th state or so thereabouts if we were to adopt something like this. Is there something that is, I guess, similar among the states that have adopted this policy? Are they blue states, red states, urban states? Is there anything that's kind of links them together?
It's actually an interesting mixture. Arizona was the first state that went out and did it. And they found the tremendous cost savings, and that from the voters to the election administrators, everybody really liked it. Where this really got a lot of momentum was after the 2012 election. President Obama appointed a bipartisan task force to study election administration. He got his election lawyer, a guy named Bob Bauer, and Ben Ginsburg, who was Mitt Romney and George W. Bush's election lawyers, to chair this task force. I actually was asked to serve. Chris Thomas, the former Michigan state election director, who was a real legend in the elections community all across the country. Chris and I and Bob and Ben and six others served. And when we were done, our unanimous recommendations included online voter registration. We went across the country to talk to different groups, Republicans and Democrats, and said, here's what we want done in the country. We think this will make shorter lines, it'll save money, it'll make our elections work better. And we've been really pleased because groups from the right, like the Republican National Lawyers Association, have said, yes, you need to do online voter registration. The voter rolls will be more accurate, more secure, it'll be cheaper, and that's something we Republicans like, as well as folks like the League of Women Voters, the ACLU, Democratic Party. So you've got a real bipartisan swell of support behind this, and that's what makes it such a great reform, is that it's something that people can really come together. It's not often where you get something that's cheaper, safer, more accurate, and so I'm excited that Michigan's considering it, and happy to try to lend my support where I can.
One other hesitation I can see is that folks might see this opening the door to online voting. Do you see that happening at any point in the near future?
I don't. You know, when I first ran for Secretary of State back in 2003, I remember in my Kentucky Education Television always hosts debates among the statewide races, the candidates for statewide office. And I remember getting asked that question. And back then, there were some studies going on testing it for military and overseas voters, because it's very hard for them to get their absentee ballot to them and then back in time to be able to be counted. Fast forward 15 years later, we're still kind of testing that out, you know, with military and overseas voters. A few states have done that, but it's hard. And I think most people still don't feel comfortable enough with the actual vote, because we want to keep that private. And we also are worried about virtual ballot boxes being stuffed. And so, you know, I think there's still reluctance to do that. Voter registration is very different. We're used to the concept of having lists on kept online and having some level of access to update information. So I think we're, you know, someday we'll probably vote online, but we'll have to see about that. But I don't think it's going to be anytime soon for a widespread, like the average voter.
All right, Trey Grayson, he is the former Secretary of State for the state of Kentucky and also with the Harvard Institute of Politics. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks. Good talking to you about this.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Trey Grayson for taking some time with us here this morning. And guys, not to freak you out, but I'm curious what that insect is on the windowsill. I'm wondering if it's a hornet, or if it's a bumblebee, or if it's a simple wasp, but it looks dangerous.
I was kind of hoping that was on the outside of the window, but now it seems to be on the inside and getting closer to us on the sill. Here.
I've been following it for some time. Whoa.
Oh, it's still alive. I can see it over there.
I think it's dead now. If it's alive,
it's totally right on that chair right
there. Oh, yep, there it is, John. Oh, I see it crawling. What? Oh! Is it? Did you get it? I think it's in the radiator now. All right.
There you have it, folks. The first live insect execution right here on the MERS podcast.
Whatever it was, it scared away the weed whackers and the lawnmowers today. They were very quiet. So we can say, we can paraphrase Woody Allen's comment about the spider that's as big as a Buick.
What was it, John?
The wasp.
Okay. Now it's a dead wasp.
Wasps like those big sun-filled window glass. It's always, they always like to hang around. It's probably to like getting a tan for a wasp.
We will not be able to put in our fine print that no animals will hurt in making this production here.
Ooh, I'd be right with you.
It wasn't animals.
Oh, okay. Well, then we're good. Good then.
And we were very humane with it, too. It was very fast. And I think it was struggling. We really put it out of its misery, really. I mean, because if it was really a wasp in good health, it would have been flying around. But I've been watching it crawl on that sill for the last, 10 minutes. So I think John did the humane thing there. So thanks, John.
No problem.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.